This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. For many Americans, the passing of Labor Day signals the end of the summer and back to school. But during presidential election years, it also serves as the kickoff for the fall general election campaign. Both Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton and Republican standard bearer Donald Trump have hit the ground running this week with multiple campaign events, including back-to-back appearances at last night's Commander-in-Chief Forum on NBC. While national polls show the race in a virtual dead heat, Clinton maintains an edge in swing state and electoral college projections. Meanwhile, Libertarian Gary Johnson and Jill Stein of the Green Party are looking to win over the large number of voters who appear unhappy with both major party candidates, but must do so in a campaign environment that is not typically friendly to third-party challengers. Today on The Exchange, it's our post-Labor Day presidential campaign kickoff. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have three guests joining me for the show this morning. With me in studio is Chris Galdieri. Chris is assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College, where he specializes in presidential politics. And Chris, it's always good to see you.
Always glad to be here, Dean. Thanks.
And joining me from Colorado is Dan Bush. Dan is digital politics editor for PBS NewsHour. And Dan, welcome back to The Exchange.
Good to see you, Dean.
And later in the show, we'll be joined by Kate Martell. Kate is a political reporter for The Hill, where she writes the 1230 Report. Gentlemen, we are 2 months out from Election Day, so let's start with an overview of where the race for president is right now. And Chris, let me first turn to you and get your sense of where we are literally 2 months from Election Day. Today is September 8th, and I believe Election Day is November 8th. So we're 2 months away.
That's right. November 8th is the latest possible day we can have the election under the Constitution.
Oh, interesting.
So this is an election that literally could not be any longer than it's going to be. As for where we stand, I think things have tightened considerably from where they were a month ago. Depending on which polls you're looking at, you probably are seeing Hillary Clinton with a lead over Donald Trump that is smaller than the one she had coming out of the Democratic National Convention. But you're also seeing the occasional poll here and there that shows Trump slightly ahead or in a tie with Clinton. So, I would say Clinton is – still leading, still probably favored to win the election. But I think, a month ago you were hearing Democrats talking about states like South Carolina and Indiana and Kansas and Utah. And I think that may have been a little bit premature.
So these are Democrats talking about the possibility that states that traditionally go Republican may go to Hillary Clinton. So Indiana, for example, I think Barack Obama won in 2008, for example.
Right. But traditionally, that tends to be a very Republican state. You're just not seeing the same sort of, exuberance about possibly flipping those states, I think.
And why do you think that is? What has changed since the conventions? We're coming out of the conventions. Clinton had a pretty sizable lead, and you mm-hmm. did hear this talk about a lot of these swing states.
Right. Well, I think part of it is just that convention bounces tend to fade, and they may have faded more slowly. Things may have been different because we had very early conventions this year. Conventions have traditionally been held in August in recent years. This year we had them in July. And then Clinton has been very roundly criticized and come under a lot of fire for things like the Clinton Foundation, the handling of her emails while she was Secretary of State and those sorts of things. And, while there's been a lot of debate over how significant those things are, I think for voters who are just starting to tune in, they're seeing a lot of coverage that suggests that something is amiss, whether or not something actually is.
Yeah. Dan, I'm interested in your general take on the race so far. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about some of the difference between the national polls and when we look at specific swing states or perhaps at the Electoral College.
Sure. So, you know, as Chris mentioned, the race has certainly tightened. We look back to the moment after the Democratic National Convention was over. Clinton had a much, you know, larger lead in the polls. As Chris said, that's sort of your typical post-convention bump. Some national polls had Clinton up by, you know, an average of as many as 8 points, even a little bit higher. That was more or less unrealistic. It's important to remember that in the last 5 presidential elections, the average margin of victory has been 4.8 points. So, you know, elections are typically pretty close. In the last several cycles, they've been decided by a few points. So now that Clinton is down to an average national lead in your average national polls of, you know, plus 2, plus 3, that's a little bit closer to what we're seeing. But as you said, you know, this is really going to come down to the battleground states. Once you start looking at those important states that have decided the last several elections, your Ohio's and Florida's and Pennsylvania's and so on, you see Clinton with a small but consistent lead in all of those states. And although Trump has been up, you know, recently by, you know, as much as 1 point in Florida and other states, and if Clinton can hold on to those key states, even if the, her lead is narrowing nationally, she still is in the driver's seat in winning the general election if she can hold on to those key battlegrounds.
Yeah, and Chris, we know you need 270 electoral votes to win the presidency. I don't think I've seen a single projection from any major prognosticator or network that shows Hillary Clinton below 300 right now. So that would suggest that even though they're in a dead heat in the national polls, that she has some built-in structural advantages. Why do you think that is?
Well, part of it is just the if you look at past history, again, you know, looking over the past 5 or 6 presidential elections, Democrats have consistently won states that have somewhere in the neighborhood of 240 electoral votes. And that's a really good starting place because that means you just need a few sizable swing states to put yourself over 270. The danger, though, is that some of those states, states like Florida, states like Ohio, if those are the states that are putting you from, you know, 250-something to the 290s or the 300s, if you're only leading them by a point or two, then a fairly small shift in the polls nationally can leave you without a path to 270.
Hey, Dan, what swing states are you going to be watching more closely? I mean, I have a list in my head of about 10 or 11, but we've only been hearing mainly about a few of them this time around.
Yeah, you know, I mean, before the cycle started, there is a wider universe of swing states that pundits and, you know, pollsters on both sides of the aisle were looking at closely. You know, that included states that President Obama either won or almost won in 2008 and 2012. That list included states like, for example, Virginia, which Obama won twice narrowly, North Carolina, which he won in 2008 and then narrowly lost to Mitt Romney in 2012, states like Colorado, Nevada, and so on. What we're seeing now, and this is probably a Trump effect more than anything else, is that some of those states have gone very solidly blue in polling. So Colorado, a state that Republicans, by, you know, every measure, should be competing in, Clinton has been leading Trump by as much as 10 points in recent polls. That is a state that Republicans no longer think they can seriously contend for. Nevada, another state that is much closer but that has consistently been voting for Hillary Clinton. Virginia, a state that Republicans were hoping to capture. And without winning Virginia, it's very hard to see a path for Donald Trump to get into that magic number, 270. Virginia has been up for Clinton by more than 10 points. So the list of, you know, quote-unquote swing states has significantly narrowed. Now we're looking, you know, more closely at a couple of the big states like Florida, like Ohio. Pennsylvania seems to be out of reach for Donald Trump at the moment. And North Carolina, one of the few competitive states where Donald Trump is doing well. But the broader takeaway is that there is a larger group of states that in the last couple of cycles have been fairly competitive, and a large portion of them have been polling so heavily for Hillary Clinton that it's made it difficult, more difficult for Donald Trump to see that path to 270.
Yeah, and Chris, let me ask you, as Dan points out, we seem to mainly be talking about a couple of big key states like Ohio and Florida. I want to ask you about Ohio in a moment and John Kasich's role there. But first, New Hampshire, you're here in the state. Mm-hmm. We've been a swing state in recent elections. We always get a lot of attention because of the primary. Where are we this time around?
We're still a swing state. We are one of the two places in New England where the Trump campaign seems to think they have a chance of winning electoral vote, the other being the second congressional district in Maine.
In Maine, where they split up their electoral votes by congressional district.
That's right. And the demographics there give the Trump campaign some hope that they could pick up that one electoral vote. Having said that, you have to go back quite a ways to find a poll in the state that shows Trump leading Clinton. The Clinton campaign has been, flooding the state with organizers. They've got, I think, something like a dozen offices, and they're opening more this week. And they're putting a lot of attention on the state. Democrats are very interested in our Senate race. They see that as one of their best opportunities for picking up a Senate seat. And the Trump campaign is not responding in kind. They don't have the same sort of organization. They don't have the same sort of infrastructure here.
Yeah, I read a statistic that said that the Clinton folks have like three times the number of staff here. I think the MUR poll had her up by 11 points or something like that just recently.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So even though he's here a lot, he's got a fairly tough road here.
Right. I think part of the problem is that he's having a hard time translating what worked for him in the primary into a general election strategy. In the primary, he would fly in, he would do an event, and then he would fly home. And that was fine when you needed to win, 30 some percent or 40 some percent of the Republican primary electorate. But that doesn't get you to winning in a general election.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you about Ohio in a moment and Dan about Florida. But first, I want to tell our listeners, we're talking about the 2016 presidential election today on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Maybe you have a favorite candidate. Maybe you're still undecided. Let us know what you're thinking. I'm joined today by Chris Galdieri from St. Anselm College and Dan Bush of PBS's NewsHour. And let me come back to you real quick, Chris. Ohio, John Kasich, who was just here, I think, campaigning for Chris Sununu for governor. Ohio is a key state. He seems to know it. Not a big Donald Trump fan.
That's right. He was very conspicuous by his absence from the Republican National Convention, which was being held in Cleveland. Traditionally, the governor of the state where the convention is being held plays a large role, a large ceremonial role in things, and he was nowhere to be seen. It doesn't look like the Ohio Republican Party is lifting a finger to help Donald Trump. Instead, their focus is on helping Rob Portman, their Republican U.S. senator, get reelected, and that they're looking like they're being pretty successful on that front, given where the money is going in that state. It's possible that Trump could pull something off in Ohio. It's one of those Midwestern states where the Trump campaign seems to think that the demographics of it give them a chance. But if he does, it will be without John Kasich's help.
Mm-hmm. excuse me, Dan, let me turn to you and ask you about Florida. I think you accurately pointed out that some of these states like Virginia, Colorado, Pennsylvania seem to be out of Trump's reach. But Florida is a really interesting state, very close, a lot of electoral votes, a lot of retired New Yorkers living down in Florida, and you have two New Yorkers essentially running for president down there.
Yeah, that's right. And, sort of about a month ago after the conventions, we saw Clinton up by 9 points, for example, in a Monmouth poll by 5 points in a CBS News YouGov poll. Now the average of the national polls from mid-August to early September show Clinton up by about 2 points. That is a narrow margin, of course, but it's important to remember that Florida is a big, diverse state that is typically very, very close, right? Famously, George Bush and George W. Bush ended up beating Al Gore by a little over 500 votes in 2000. So a lead of 2 or 3 points in Florida is a significant margin. And, I was doing some reporting on different parts of Florida recently, and sources kept telling me, 2 or 3 points in Florida is equivalent to a larger lead mm-hmm. in another state. And in Florida, as you just mentioned, you look at the votes that Donald Trump needs to get, you know, in a state like Ohio, a state like Pennsylvania, he needs to turn out mostly white, a lot of men as well, to compete. And the numbers just don't really seem to be there for him. So you look specifically at your counties like Miami-Dade, around Miami, Pinellas, around St. Petersburg, Hillsborough, around Tampa, and Orange, around Orlando. Those are the four big metropolitan areas in Florida where the majority of the city, urban and suburban population is. Those areas right now are moving very, very heavily for Hillary Clinton. And although Donald Trump may pick up votes in the panhandle in northern Florida, the joke is the farther north in Florida, the farther south you go, the more conservative it is. It's hard to see how those numbers offset the gains that Hillary Clinton is going to make among Hispanics, among African Americans, and among college-educated whites.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you real quick about Wisconsin and Michigan. These are two states that I've heard Donald Trump say he thinks he can take. What's your sense? Is that a possibility, or is he just sort of talking there?
Well, the Trump campaign has been saying for a long time that they can compete in those states, but realistically, they've never had a very good chance. They've never been particularly close in the polls, although the polls have narrowed in some states in the Midwest. And Donald Trump has keyed in on those states as places where there is a larger percentage of his base of white working class voters who are upset with the economy, upset with trades, and so on. But when you look at the voting patterns of those states, and I have those numbers in front of me, Wisconsin has not voted for a Republican president since presidential candidate since 1984.
Oh, interesting. That's an interesting fact.
You mentioned Michigan. Michigan has not voted for a Republican presidential candidate since 1988. So these are states, although that we think of them as swing states, when you look at the numbers, have voted consistently Democratic for a very long time, and it's unlikely that that is going
to
change.
Yeah, so if he were to take those states, I think Hillary Clinton's campaign would be in real trouble. Chris, let me come back to you. We've talked about ground game a little bit, in the traditional sense of Hillary Clinton has a lot more people here than Donald Trump. But, one of the things we talk about is how Donald Trump is not using a traditional ground game strategy, that he has this idea that he can sort of use the media in a way as kind of his ground game. Say a little bit of your thoughts about that, about how he has his lack of a ground game, whether you think that's a bad thing, and what about this idea that he can win, which he believes he can win without that.
Sure. Well, let's talk about ground games first. I mean, there's been a lot of really interesting research over the past, 15 or 20 years that's found that a lot of the techniques campaigns use have varying levels of effectiveness. So, for instance, a face-to-face conversation with someone like you at your door, it can be really effective in both persuading someone and in getting them to turn out to vote. We know phone calls from volunteers are effective in a way that phone calls from people being paid to make calls are not, that sort of thing. And I don't think, a ground game alone wins elections, but in a close election, I think they can make a difference of, 2, 3, even 4 points. And I think part of the reason it could matter this time that Trump does not have a traditional ground game is that usually both campaigns have them. So they sort of cancel each other out to an extent. So, back in 2012, the Obama campaign was working to turn out its voters. The Romney campaign was working to turn out its voters. I think the Obama campaign did a better job of that, but there was still an effort on the Romney campaign's part. I think what could be dangerous for Trump, especially in a close state, we're talking about states like, let's say in Ohio, it's a 1 point race going in to the election. A good ground game could turn that into a 2 or a 3 point victory for Clinton. So I think Trump is missing out here by not.
Well, I know this is political scientists are sort of breathlessly waiting to see this is going to upend all the theories of what you need to win an election.
Right. And we usually don't get to run an experiment that is, well, what if one candidate didn't have a ground game and now one is doing that for us.
It's so a great campaign.
It's an amazing contribution to political science. Yes,
we do need to take a quick break here, but coming up, we're going to start talking about voters, and we're going to spend some time talking about policy, particularly that commander-in-chief forum last night. We've got some sound for you, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, the post-Labor Day presidential campaign outlook. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Maybe you're following a particular candidate. Maybe you're undecided. We're interested to hear your thoughts here. 1-800-892-6477. I'm joined in studio by Chris Galdieri, assistant professor of politics at St. Anselm College, and joining us from Colorado, I believe, is Dan Bush, who is a digital politics editor at PBS's NewsHour. And Dan, before the break, Chris was talking about Trump's media strategy. You know, we're political scientists kind of watching from the sidelines. You, as someone from the media, are right in the middle of this. I'm interested in your thoughts about this idea of sort of a non-ground game.
Yeah, so PBS NewsHour looked at the ground games of both candidates in crucial swing states. You cited before the statistic that Clinton had three times as many offices. That came from a story that a colleague and I, Lisa Desjardins, did, and we found that through August 30th, Hillary Clinton had 291 field offices in the 15 biggest swing states, in Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Iowa, some of the states we've been talking about. Donald Trump had 88. You know, he had one field office in Florida. He had two field offices in Pennsylvania. You know, he had a smattering of offices in Virginia, zero offices in North Carolina. So, you know, field offices are just one metric. His campaign has argued that he is not running a traditional campaign, that he does not need the on-the-ground investment that previous candidates had because he can rely on earned media, on free media, that is, and on, you know, Trump's name recognition overall. That worked in the primaries, but in general elections are different. Donald Trump got, you know, the 14 million or so votes that he got in the primaries. In a general, he needs to turn out an additional 55 or 60 million people. And although some of them will vote for him just because, you know, they are excited about his campaign, they want change, and so on, a large percentage of those voters need to be reached. They need to be persuaded. And field offices are places where campaigns bring volunteers together to make phone calls, to organize, to map out on a precinct-by-precinct basis which voters are targetable, which voters they need to, you know, ensure are going to come to the polls. And Donald Trump just does not have that infrastructure. Now, his campaign said that he would be opening, you know, new offices in some of those states, and we're waiting to see if that's happened. But without that infrastructure in place, it's very difficult to get voters who might sit on the sidelines to actually turn out.
Mm-hmm. And I think both you and Chris raised the point that if he can do this without the kind of infrastructure we typically see, it's going to change a lot of thinking about how to run campaigns. Gentlemen, I want to talk a little bit about voters now. A couple things up front here. We had an email from Christopher who asked us to discuss the hidden Trump voter. And Christopher says, despite the polls, isn't this ultimately a change election? And didn't Trump surprise the media and pundits throughout the primaries? And I also want to listen here to Donald Trump in Manchester recently, giving us a sense of how he sees the voting divide in America.
The real divide in this election is not between left and right, but between everyday working people and a corrupt political establishment that works only for itself. This election is a chance for the great majority of decent citizens to end the rule of a small group of special interests and to return that power to the voters, or, as we would say, to the people.
That is Donald Trump speaking in Manchester at the end of August, talking about how he sees the divide in American politics. And Chris, let me turn to you. Strong populist message there from Donald Trump. And we also heard from Christopher's email this idea that there are these Trump voters that we're just not really familiar with, but they're there and they could conceivably give him the margin of victory.
Right. The idea here is that there are a lot of people who are not regular voters, who are infrequent voters, who will come out for Donald Trump but didn't come out for, you know, Mitt Romney or John McCain in the past. And I really don't think that's likely to happen. And in part, I think also cutting against that is the fact that the sort of strong populist message you're talking about has turned off a lot of voters, and I think is helping motivate them to turn out. I think one of Trump's biggest weaknesses that we're seeing is that he is losing the support of college-educated white voters, and this has been a block of the electorate that has been reliably Republican going back several decades, and now seems to be leaning decisively towards Hillary Clinton. So even if there were, you know, this surge of, you know, hidden Trump voters to come out, I don't know that that would offset those losses.
Again, we're talking about the 2016 presidential race here on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us exchange@nhpr.org. And Dan, let me have your thoughts on this hidden Trump voter and this populist message.
Sure. You know, this is something that Republican sources bring up again and again to me, the idea that, you know, there are people out there who, you know, aren't reflecting polls who are going to vote for Donald Trump. It's interesting. And, you know, it goes back to what political scientists refer to as the Bradley effect. This was an election in 1982 for the governorship of California. An African-American mayor of Los Angeles named Tom Bradley was running. And people in polls said they were supportive of him, but he lost the election. And as it turned out, you know, voters were significantly less willing to support a black candidate than in the ballot box at the polls than they had told pollsters. And so this idea emerged that people will tell a pollster that they're comfortable voting for somebody, but in the privacy of the ballot box, will do another thing. And there could potentially be a kind of reverse Bradley effect going on here, and that's something that Republicans argue, that people in polls feel reluctant to say that they will vote for Donald Trump because they believe that saying so is an implicit endorsement of Donald Trump's more controversial positions. It's an implicit endorsement of, you know, sexism or, you know, bigotry or, you know, sort of prejudice against immigrants, for example, but that when they actually get to the ballot box, they are going to vote. they're going to vote for Donald Trump, and that may be the case. You know, it may be that there are voters who are not telling pollsters they support him who will go to the polls. The question is, how many of those voters are there really, and are there enough to make up for the difference? You know, with Hillary's lead among, as you noted, you know, college-educated voters, women in particular, minorities, and the other voting blocs that are solidly Democratic.
Yeah, and Chris, this really seems like make or break for Donald Trump, not having a lot of success with the minority outreach, Latinos, African-Americans, correct?
That's right. And, you know, for Clinton to win this election, one of the things she needs to do is recreate that Obama coalition,
right,
and to have, you know, a large African-American vote, a large Hispanic vote, and have them break decisively for her. And just to go back to the idea of hidden Trump voters,
sure,
we actually do have some ability to test this because there are so many polls being taken in different methods. Some polls use live callers. Some use an automatic caller or online polls where you're not interacting with a person.
So-called robocalls.
Right, a robocall or an online poll. And so far, there's no clear trend. If there really were a hidden Trump vote, you'd expect to see a decisive difference in robocalls or online polls compared to live caller polls. And so far, there isn't any clear evidence of that sort of vote.
Gentlemen, let's go to the phones. We have Andrew joining us in Keene. Andrew, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. I know you guys have moved kind of past this, but I am kind of curious.
Sure.
I noticed a lot of times, especially in the debates, Trump comes up as a way to try and find out where a lot of the local candidates stand. I'm wondering, does that help or hurt him, especially as you guys have very well noted that he doesn't have very much of a ground game, if any, at all around here in New Hampshire?
So, Andrew, your question is, if I'm understanding you, is what is the impact of local races on the presidential race?
Kind of, yeah, because a lot of times they'll go through a local debate. This especially happened on Tuesday nights when they had the U.S. Senate races, where they're wondering how the top of the ticket impacts.
Sure.
So I'm wondering if that counts as like kind of that free media you were talking about, and if that helps or hurts them.
Yeah, great question. Dan, let me turn to you. The impact of these down ticket races on the presidential race is something we talk about a lot.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, for months now we've been talking about a Trump drag, the idea that Trump's unpopularity with large segments of the electorate is going to have a negative effect on Republicans who are running down ballot, primarily Republicans running for the Senate for re-election or for election in the House and also in state legislatures. Interestingly, we're seeing less of a Trump drag than I think a lot of people predicted earlier this summer. Ohio is a good example where Rob Portman is running for re-election against Ted Strickland, the former governor of the state. And that was a race that was earmarked as a very tight contest, as a race that Democrats could potentially win. And we should note that Democrats need, I think it is five seats to take back control of the Senate. So these races are very, very important. But in Ohio, you know, the Portman is up, and you take an average of polls in the state from mid-July to late August, it looks like, and he's up by 7.5 points. So, you know, and we see that over and over again in other states. Marco Rubio, of course, who dropped out of the presidential race, looks to be in decent position in Florida. So you're seeing Republicans who are walking a fine line in down-ballot races, but who are able to distance themselves enough from Donald Trump, you know, who are saying some of his more controversial positions are not things we endorse, who are able to, as of right now, fend off Democrats. And if that trend persists, we could see, even if Donald Trump loses at the presidential level, we might see Republicans do better than expected in the House and in the Senate.
And Andrew, thank you for that call. We have an email from Jeff in Canterbury, and Jeff read my mind because he wants us to talk a little bit about third-party candidates, which is what I would like to talk about as well. So let me turn to you, Chris. We have these two third-party candidates, Gary Johnson, a Libertarian, Jill Stein, a Green. How are they doing? What are their prospects? Is it going to make a difference in any way in the presidential race?
Okay. In terms of their prospects, I don't think either one of them is going to become president. In terms of how they're doing, right now they're both doing better than they did in 2012. Johnson in particular has gotten a lot of attention since he chose Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, as his running mate. The Libertarian Party, it's this weird mix of, you know, serious thinkers and aspirants for political office and people with somewhat unusual notions as well. And I think a lot of so to have two former governors, two former Republicans on that ticket, I think gives it a gravitas that it hasn't had in the past. Stein, I think, she ran in 2012 as the Green nominee. I think she got something like 1% of the vote. I think she's probably on track to, you know, maybe double that. In part, I think she's trying to get the really disaffected Sanders voters, the folks who didn't think of themselves as Democrats, but rather as, you know, liberals or leftists or socialists or what have you. But I think it's possible that they could make a difference in some states, particularly Johnson. If he's making a big push out west, and the Clinton campaign is looking at Arizona as one of their reach states, well, if Gary Johnson gets 10% of the vote in Arizona, that's probably going to hurt Trump more than it does Clinton and might give her an avenue to winning that state's electoral votes.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, let me ask you, I talk to progressives and libertarians and they get a little upset when you talk about Ralph Nader in 2000 and the potential for either of their candidates being spoilers. But what do you see as their role in this particular election?
That's right. Gary Johnson has been around 10 points in polls in which he's included. Jill Stein, as Chris mentioned, is, down around an average of 3 points or so. That might grow a little bit. Neither one of them is very likely to be president, of course. But the support for Johnson, more than anything, is a reflection of voter frustration with the political process. You know, a lot of libertarians, independents, and even some moderates and Republicans and Democrats saying, we don't want to vote for Donald Trump. He's not temperamentally fit for president. And at the same time, we don't trust Hillary Clinton. Voters who want to be a part of the process but don't want to cast a vote for any of the two major party nominees are turning to Johnson. It's unclear what impact that will have on the general election. You look at past history. Ross Perot is the most successful third-party candidate ever, at least in modern presidential history. He won 18.9% of the vote in 1992. That helped elect Bill Clinton, who won 43% of the vote and edged out George Bush, the incumbent Republican, by about 6 points. Ross Perot in that election drew Republicans away from the Republican nominee, helped elect Bill Clinton in 1996. 4 years later, he still won 8% of the vote. Nobody expects Gary Johnson to do as well as Ross Perot, but he could in some important states. Arizona, excuse me, is one example. He could draw votes away from Donald Trump and make this, you know, an easier victory for Hillary Clinton. But it's just, you know, at this point, it's a little too early to tell. You know, it'll be interesting to see where Gary Johnson is in the polls a month from now after the first debate and when voters are really sort of making up their minds.
And Chris, safe to say, if Johnson doesn't get into those debates, that's really bad news for him.
It is. And it's really tough for a third party to get into those debates. I think you have to have a 15% support.
Yeah, I heard Bernie Sanders say the other day that it really should be lower than that, but 15% is what it is.
Yeah, 15% is what it is, and this commission's been in place since the mid-90s. I did find it interesting that in the last day or so, Mitt Romney said that he thought that Johnson should be included in the debates. It's not an endorsement, but it's also, you know, I think, you know, it, for Romney watchers, I think that's a statement worth paying attention to.
Gentlemen, let's talk a little bit now about policy, shift gears from the race and talk about policy. And we can certainly fold in the third-party candidates as well. Listeners, you can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Emails exchange at nhpr.org. I'm here with Chris Galdieri of St. Anselm College and Dan Bush of PBS. Last night, NBC had this Commander-in-Chief Forum, which raised a number of interesting questions about foreign policy and the role of either of these candidates as our potential next Commander-in-Chief, and I want to let you hear a little bit of what was discussed last night. And let's start with Donald Trump talking about his temperament as a potential Commander-in-Chief.
Well, I think absolutely. I think if you saw what happened in Mexico the other day, where I went there, had great relationships, everything else, I let them know where the United States stands. I mean, we've been badly hurt by Mexico, both on the border and with taking all of our jobs or a big percentage of our jobs. And if you look at what happened, look at the aftermath today where the people that arranged the trip in Mexico have been forced out of government.
Back in August.
And that's how well we're going to have to do, Matt.
That is Donald Trump speaking at last night's Commander-in-Chief forum in New York City on NBC. And Dan, let me turn to you. This issue of Trump's temperament and foreign policy, it's something that the Clinton campaign has really focused on. I've seen a number of ads that use clips of him on the stump, and they want to highlight him as kind of being kind of very unpredictable. They use the word hothead, et cetera. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, the Clinton campaign, that's been their focus through the summer. It's reminiscent of 2012 when the Obama campaign tried to paint a picture of Mitt Romney as a corporate raider, somebody who had outsourced jobs, you know, taken over companies, eliminated U.S. jobs, who had helped corporations and the wealthy get richer and hurt lower and middle income Americans. You know, that portrait ended up sticking with Romney and helping Obama in the end differentiate himself in an election that he probably, you know, should have been tighter than it was. This time around, Hillary Clinton and her surrogates have spent the entire summer sort of pounding away that message, saying Donald Trump is not temperamentally fit to be president. And, you know, that view of Donald Trump, you know, had been there before, and it seems to have solidified to a certain extent
Dan,
among voters.
Let me jump in here a second. We have to take one more break. Chris Galdieri has to leave us. I want to thank you so much. And we'll
be
joined by Kate Martell after the break. Stay with us. It's The Exchange on NHPR.
All the viewers watching you tonight, I have a lot of experience dealing with classified material, starting when I was on the Senate Armed Services Committee, going into the 4 years as Secretary of State. Classified material has a header which says top secret, secret, confidential. Nothing. And I will repeat this, and this is verified in the report by the Department of Justice. None of the emails sent or received by me had such a header.
That is Hillary Clinton last night talking about her personal email server on the NBC Commander-in-Chief Forum. And, Kate, let me turn to you. I believe you watched, you had a chance to watch the show last night. I think she spent 10 minutes talking about the email. Your sense of how this issue is impacting her campaign now?
You know, Dean, it's very much impacting her campaign. The fact that she had to spend a third of her time last night fending off questions and attacks about her emails shows the drip, drip, drip of the Clinton campaign. They haven't been able to get past that issue because she really does lack a knockout rebuttal of the email scandal. She always keeps answering the question, but, you know, it doesn't seem to quite satisfy voters, and especially in a crowd of military and veteran personnel, that's something that might not quite cut it, but she keeps having to answer that. But when she starts getting into the ins and outs of what seems classified, what's not, comes down to is Joseph Comey said that there have been classified information. So whatever answer she says, the facts are that there are some classified information, and she hasn't been able to get away from these attacks.
Dan, I'm interested in your thoughts as well. You know, she's been criticized for being defensive on this issue, and it certainly took up a good chunk of her 30 minutes last night.
Yeah, and, you know, this is something that, as Kate mentioned, you know, this is not an issue that the Clinton campaign wants to be focused on with 60-some-odd days in the low 60s left before the election. They want to be speaking about the economy. They want to be focused on, you know, their argument that Donald Trump is not temperamentally fit to be president. But the email issue keeps coming back, and it's something that, you know, voters tell me, and you know, it's reflected in polls, continually touch on the idea that Clinton is untrustworthy, and the emails are part of that. This is a problem for Hillary Clinton, without a doubt. There are a lot of different factors that go into her untrustworthiness, you know, that are sort of complicated and hard to unpack, that have to do with her baggage, with her gender, you know, with some of her reversals on some issues like gay marriage, for example. But, you know, the emails are certainly part of it, and it's something that Clinton has had sort of trouble dealing with and has been ineffective in making go away as an issue. And if you take a step back from the campaign, it's indicative, I think, of the difficulty that presidential candidates now face in changing the narrative in elections, right? You know, you go back a couple of decades and these stories were reported less, but candidates as well had more control of what it was that was being talked about in a campaign. And, you know, in today's 24/7 media world, where there are, you know, very partisan outlets on the left and on the right, if people want to make an issue out of something like the emails, it's difficult for Hillary Clinton to make that go away. It's something that, you know, is proving to be impossible to do, in fact.
And one of the other issues that Donald Trump was asked about last night was his preparation for Commander-in-Chief, given that he's coming from outside of government to run for president. Let's listen to what he had to say last night.
Well, I've built a great company. I've been all over the world. I've dealt with foreign countries. I've done very well, as an example, tremendously well dealing with China and dealing with so many of the countries that are just ripping this country. They are just taking advantage of us like nobody's ever seen before. And I've had great experience dealing on an international basis. I look today and I see a Russian plane circling our planes. They're taunting us.
That is Donald Trump last night at NBC's Commander-in-Chief Forum. And Kate, let me turn to you. This is something we've heard on the stump consistently, Donald Trump putting forth his business record as a qualification for Commander-in-Chief.
Keen, I'm stunned that Trump, in a room full of veterans, says that he's still running a business while he's running for Commander-in-Chief. To me, that didn't seem like the crowd that you wanted to be saying a statement like that. And, you know, my biggest takeaway is that Donald Trump is trying to, you know, use some of the attacks that Hillary Clinton has been using on him. Yesterday in Philadelphia, he had a rally where he was using all of the same attacks that Hillary Clinton has been using on him, calling her trigger-happy, very unstable, and calling her reckless, that he's trying to be able to pull these attacks away from himself onto her. But what you're showing is that, you know, this is Trump's party. We're all just in it. You know, so we're all just kind of standing by watching idly that Donald Trump is going to say whatever he wants, especially on some of these issues, that he may not have some of the specific policy answers. That was a big criticism last night. And Matt Lauer's big criticism for not pushing him on some of these policy issues. And I think we're just seeing that Donald Trump is kind of trying to write his own tone, and see how this goes through November.
Mm-hmm. And Dan, it was interesting last night. Kate refers to this moment where Trump said, they asked him about, Matt Lauer asked him about preparation for Commander-in-Chief, and he's been criticized for, not really preparing for the debates as well. And his answer was, he's talking to people and he's very busy because he's running a company. Surprised me a little bit as well.
Yeah, it certainly did. Probably not something that, Trump's advisors were hoping for, an answer like that. Trump has made the argument that because he is successful in business, that he will be successful as the leader of this country. It's an argument that people have made in the past, and business people have made in the past, like Ross Perot, who I mentioned earlier, the most successful third-party candidate ever, and they fail. So, if Trump wins with an argument like that, it would be an exception to the rule, and, it stands to see whether voters will accept that, whether voters will say that because he has run a company, because he has opened golf courses and put his name on skyscrapers around the world, that is a stand-in for, a solid foreign policy. And, the proof is going to be in the pudding, and we'll see, especially in the first debate, whether Donald Trump can show sort of a greater grasp of world affairs.
And it is true, we have had other candidates run as business outsiders. Ross Perot, obviously the example you mentioned earlier, Dan. Let's listen to a little bit of Hillary Clinton from last night talking about this very controversial deal, certainly within the context of the election. It's been controversial with Iran.
So, yes, I put together the coalition. We imposed the sanctions. We got them to the negotiating table. And after I left, we got the agreement. That agreement put a lid on their nuclear weapons program and imposed intrusive inspections.
That is Hillary Clinton last night at NBC's Commander-in-Chief Forum talking about dealing with Iran. And Kate, this is something where she is, obviously she's Secretary of State. She's very closely linked to the Obama administration on this and a number of other foreign policy issues.
Yes, exactly, Dean. And this is something that she's going to be touting. The fact that she's Secretary of State, that's the pillar of what she's running on, especially when it comes to foreign policy. And that's when she can try to differentiate herself from Donald Trump, saying that Donald Trump may not have some specific policy solutions, as she can point to the Obama administration. Obama this morning actually did respond about this issue and about when he's on his Asia trip. And basically, he's supporting her. So, he's in a tough spot right now. He's had tough administration on foreign policy. A lot of things have escalated in the world, both domestically and internationally. So it's a strong argument for Donald Trump to make, saying, look at her record, look at President Obama's record. You can tie them together. And that's what he's running on.
And one final piece of sound I want to listen to from last night is a very interesting exchange between Matt Lauer and Donald Trump on his views, essentially a comparison between Vladimir Putin and President Obama. Let's hear what he said.
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. I mean, you can say, oh, isn't that a terrible thing he called? I mean, the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. We have a divided country. We have a country where you have Hillary Clinton with her emails that nobody's ever seen, where she deletes 33,000 emails. And that's after getting a subpoena from Congress. If you do that in private business, you get thrown in jail.
That's Donald Trump last night at NBC's Commander-in-Chief Forum talking about Vladimir Putin and the Clinton emails. And Dan, let me turn to you. Donald Trump's fascination with Putin is something that's gotten a lot of commentary for some time now. Why do you think he keeps coming back to this?
It's very interesting and unusual. Conventional wisdom would hold that, praising a Russian president, somebody who the rest of the world views as an autocratic leader of, a country dealing with a raft of economic and social issues, is not a winning strategy. But Donald Trump, to his credit, has been very good for the last year plus at reading the American electorate. And what we see over and over again in polls is that voters are very frustrated with a Congress that they see as ineffectual, that is not addressing the main concerns of the country, And part of that is indecisiveness. And when Donald Trump praises Vladimir Putin, it's a semi-coded message to American voters that he values a leader who is willing to get things done, you know, regardless of how controversial they are. And so for some voters, I think that that message, strange as it may seem, is actually resonating because they're interpreting it as, you know, Donald Trump supporting somebody who, you know, can break through the gridlock, can get results, whatever they are. And that's something that voters really want to see, I think, at this point.
And Kate, Dan mentioned voter frustration, and we have an email from Andy in the Upper Valley. And Andy is curious about the role of political parties. He says that, you know, both of these major party candidates are very unpopular, but yet lots of people are still voting for them, even if they're unhappy. So your thoughts about the role of party versus just picking a candidate based on individual values. Andy wraps up his email saying, in other words, are parties pushing the party ideals rather than the candidates?
You know, there's more to a point where parties are completely shifting. And, you know, especially on foreign policy, that a lot of foreign policy hawks historically vote Republican. And now we're seeing a spot where Donald Trump's foreign policy has been a little wishy-washy, that we're seeing a lot of Republican hawks voting for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, going back to the last night, whatever message Trump has been making to these moderate Republicans to, you know, appeal to these foreign policy establishment leaders was blown apart last night. You know, refusing to back away from Putin, who's considered an enemy by a lot of Republican leaders, is a very bold statement. And that goes back to, we're in this two-party system that's completely shifting. And I think we're starting to see people voting a little bit more with their guts, a little less with their party lines. And, you know, I like to point to, in 2012, at this time of the year, 5% of the electorate had been undecided between Romney and Obama. Now, shift now, it's 17%. That's a major, major shift, showing that people may not be voting with the party as much as they have been in the past. And we're seeing people look at McMullen, we're seeing people look at Gary Johnson, although Gary Johnson had quite the flap this morning when he was asked on Morning Joe whether what he would do about Aleppo, and his answer is, what is Aleppo? So that might start shifting around how people are going to be voting a little bit. But it'll be interesting to see how that translates down ballot races. Will that, you know, tilt it in the direction of Democrats and help them take the Senate, or will people still maybe abstain from voting on the top of the ballot or vote differently how they usually vote and still stick the same party on down ballot elections?
Let's go to the phones. John is joining us from Goffstown. John, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Question.
I appreciate the chance to talk. I've been wondering about what happens after the election. I mean, Trump isn't going to go away, and the populism that he has tapped into and that Bernie Sanders tapped into, and evident, you know, the Brexit and some of the right-wing populist parties in Europe, there seems to be a real upswell of the kind of anti-establishment feeling. What's going to happen after the election?
Yeah, good question. John, let me turn to you, Dan, and then Kate, just to get your thoughts on where we go from here.
Yeah, so, you know, quickly, you know, the Trump phenomenon is not going to go away. Trump is clearly, tapped into, you know, a large group of voters who are disaffected. They're frustrated with the political system. Many of them feel left behind in the post-recession economy. Many of them are working class, are white, are less educated. Most of them are male as well. And that frustration is not simply going to disappear on November 9th. You know, whether Trump wins or loses. And what we're seeing is a very slow motion reaction to the demographic changes in this country. And demographers say that the country will be majority minority. That is, that majority of voters and residents of the U.S. will not be white in 2044 or so. So we have a couple more decades of this sort of reaction to the changing face of America, to the changing economy. And that is going to continue to play a very important role in future elections.
And Kate, your thoughts about where we go from here?
Dan is totally right. This isn't going away anytime fast. What I'll be most interested to see is the autopsy report, especially from the Republican Party. We've seen Reince Priebus with his hands tied and a lot of the Republican establishment being unclear of how necessarily to handle a Donald Trump. We still have a lot of congressional leaders supporting him, and even after his attack on the Gold Star family. And we've just seen kind of an awkward moment for the Republican Party. In 2012, the autopsy report said that they needed to be more accepting of minorities, and especially on immigration. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this translates into the next parties. Will we see a more permanent shift of more hawkish voters voting for a Democratic candidate, maybe not a progressive, but will that shift the parties at all? Or will we go back to, you know, the same system we've been? I think a lot of it, like Sam was saying, depends on where the economy goes, where we head with domestic and international terrorism, how ISIS is handled. I think we're at a really big crossroads, and 2018 is going to be a really interesting time to see with down ballot races, how does this actually play out?
Well, I remember the 2012 autopsy report, and the party's gone in a very different direction. So I think we're going to have a very interesting and exciting period ahead of us for Republicans, but also for Democrats as well. We are out of time. I'd like to thank both of my guests, Dan Bush from the PBS NewsHour. Dan, thanks so much.
Thanks, as always, for having me, Dean.
And thanks to you as well, Kate. We're so glad you could join us.
Thanks so much, Dean.
That's Kate Martell. She's a political reporter for The Hill, where she writes the 1230 report. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. This is The Exchange.